The morning started off as the previous day had ended. Everybody was in high spirits, laughing at the breakfast table. The servants skylarked as they broke camp and repacked the trucks. And by 7 o'clock we'd left the road and were following the edge of the pan. The Land Rover leading and the truck following our tracks through scrub and rank grass and across the dry ravines which meandered down to the pan. We'd been going for an hour when I saw a flash of pale movement among the trees ahead of us, and three stately gemsbok broke out onto the open pan and trotted in single file away from us. They moved heavily like fat ponies, the pale mulberry of their coats and the elaborate black and white face masks standing out clearly against the grey of the pan surface. Loren slammed the brakes on the Land Rover, and with the smoothly executed timing of the professional, the old Matabele gunbearer put the big .375 Magnum Holland & Holland into Loren's hand, and he was gone, running doubled up behind the fringe of grass that lined the edge of the pan. "Is he going to kill them?" asked Sally in her little girl voice. I nodded, and she went on. "But why? Why?" "It's one of the things he likes doing." "But they're so beautiful," she protested. "Yes," I agreed. Out on the pan, about 600 yards from the Land Rover, the gemsbok had stopped. They were standing broadside to us, staring at us intently, with heads held high and long, slender horns erect. "What's he doing?" And Sal pointed at Lorin, who was still running along the edge of the pan. "He's playing the rules," I explained. "It's an offence to fire within 500 yards of a vehicle." "Jolly sporting," she muttered, biting her lip and glancing from Lorin to the distant gemsbok. And then suddenly she had jumped from the Land Rover and clambered up onto the engine bonnet. She cupped her hands around her mouth and yelled, "Run, you fools! Run, damn you!" She snatched her hat and waved it over her head, jumping up and down on the bonnet and howling like a banshee. Out on the pan, the gemsbok erupted into startled flight, galloping diagonally away from us in a bunch. I glanced at Lorin's small figure and saw him drop into a sitting position with elbows braced on his knees, head cocked over the telescopic sight. The rifle jerked, and smoke spurted from the muzzle. But it was a second or two before the flat report of the shot reached us. Out on the pan, the leading gemsbok slid over his nose and rolled in a drift of white dust. Lorin fired again, and the second animal tumbled, with legs kicking to the sky. The last gemsbok ran on alone. Behind me, the old gunbearer spoke to the other in Sindabili.
"Oh, this is Majman."
Sally climbed down off the bonnet and sat silently while I drove to where Lorin waited. He handed the rifle to the gunbearer, and as I relinquished the wheel to him, the bitter tang of burnt cordite filled the cab of the Land Rover. He glanced at Sally. "Thanks," he said. "I prefer a running shot." "Why didn't you kill all three of them?" Her tone was neutral, without rancor. "You're only allowed two on a license." "Christ," said Sally, in a voice that now reeked of anger and outrage. "How bloody touching. 'Tisn't often you meet a true gentleman." And Lorin drove us out to where the dead animals lay. While the servants skinned and butchered the carcasses, Sally remained in the back seat with her face averted, her hat pulled down low over her forehead and her eyes glued to a book. I stood beside Lorin in the bright sunlight that was intensified by the glare of the white salt surface and watched the gun boys cut the incisions in the skin and flay the gemsbok with the skill of a pair of Harley Street surgeons. "You might have warned me we had one of them on this trip," Lorin told me bitterly. "Am I ever regretting having given in to you and letting her come along?" I didn't reply, and he went on. I've a bloody good mind to send her back to Maun on one of the trucks. The suggestion was so unworkable that it didn't even give me a twinge, and Lorin went on immediately. She's your assistant. Try and keep her under control, will you? I moved away, giving him time to recover his temper, and took the map case from the seat beside Sally. She didn't look up from her book. I walked around the vehicle and spread the aeronautical large-scale map on the bonnet of the Land Rover, and within 2 minutes, Lorin was with me. Navigation is one of his big things, and he fancies himself no end. We'll leave the pan here, and he pointed to where a dry riverbed joined the eastern extremity of the pan, and strike in on a compass bearing. What kind of going will we meet, I wonder? Sand felt, as like as not. I've never been in there before. Let's ask the drivers, I suggested. Good idea. Lorin called the two of them across, and the gun boys, who had by now finished the skilled work and were leaving the rest to the camp boys, joined us, as was their right. This is where we want to go, Lorin pointed it out on the map. These hills here. They haven't got a name marked, but they run in line with the edge of the pan, like this. It took a moment or two for the drivers to figure out their bearings on the chart, and then a remarkable change came over both of them. Their features dissolved into blank masks of incomprehension. What kind of country is it between the pan and the hills? Lorin asked. He hadn't sensed the change in them. The drivers exchanged furtive glances. Well? Asked Lorin. I do not know that country. I have never heard of these hills. It was Joseph, the elder driver, and then went on to give himself the lie. Besides, there is much sand, and there are riverbeds which one cannot cross. There is no water, agreed David, the second driver. I have never been there. I have never heard of these hills either. What do the white men seek? Asked the old gun boy in Sindabili. It was very obvious that maps meant nothing to him. They want to go to Katubangazi, the driver explained quickly. They were all convinced by now that neither Lorin nor I had mastery of the language, and that they could speak freely in front of us. This, then, was the first time I heard the name spoken, Katubangazi, the Hills of Blood. What have you told them? Demanded the gunbearer. That we do not know the place. Good, the gunbearer agreed. Tell them that there are no elephant there, and that the wild animals are south of the pan. The driver dutifully relayed this intelligence, and was disappointed in our obvious lack of dismay. Well, Lorin told them pleasantly, you'll learn something today. For the first time, you'll see these hills. And he rolled up the map. Now get the meat loaded, and let's get on. In 5 minutes, the whole tone of the expedition had changed. Sally and the entire staff were all in the deepest depression. The smiles and horseplay were gone. There were sulky faces and meetings in muttering groups. The tempo of work dropped to almost zero. And it took almost half an hour to load the butchered Gemsbok. While this was happening, I led Lorin away from the cluster of vehicles out of earshot and quickly told him of the exchange between the African servants. Hills of blood! Wonderful! Lorin enthused. It means that almost certainly they know about the ruins, and there's probably a taboo on them. Yes, I agreed. But now we are going to have to watch for attempts to sabotage the trip. Look at them. We turned to watch the slow motion, almost somnambulistic movements of our staff. My guess is that it's going to take longer to reach the hills of blood than we allowed for. We got off the pan once more, for the going is suspect with soft places beneath the crust that will bog a vehicle. And we followed the firm but sandy ground along the edge. We crossed another of the steep ravines, after having scouted for a place where the banks were flattened, and drove on for 20 minutes before we realized that neither of the trucks were following us. After waiting 10 minutes, with both Lurin and I fuming impatiently, we turned back and retraced our course to the dry riverbed. One truck was hanging half over the edge of the ravine, one front wheel and one rear wheel not touching earth, but its belly heavily grounded. The other truck was parked nearby, and 14 grown men were sitting or standing around in various attitudes of relaxation, without making the least attempt to free the stranded truck.
"Joseph," Lurin called the driver, "how did this happen?"
Joseph shrugged his shoulders disinterestedly, but he was having difficulty hiding his satisfaction.
"All right, gentlemen, let's get it out," Lurin suggested with heavy irony.
Half an hour later, despite the ladylike efforts of all 14 of them, and despite Joseph's hearty clashing of gears and desperate engine racing and stalling, the truck still hung over the edge of the ravine. Finally, they all climbed out of the ravine and looked at Lurin and me with interest.
"Okay, Ben," Lurin turned to me as he began to strip his bush jacket. "All right, Lo," I agreed. I was delighted to see how well Lurin had taken care of himself. His body looked rock-hard and denuded of fatty tissue. At 6'2", he carried a mass of muscle whose outlines beneath the skin were unblurred. I kept my shirt on. My body, although it has the same utility as Lurin's, is not so good to look at.
"Front end first," Lurin suggested. The truck had been unloaded, petrol tank about half filled. I estimated the front end weight at a little over 2,000 pounds. I windmilled my arms as I looked at the problem, loosening up cold muscles. The servants looked puzzled, and one of them giggled. Even Sally put aside her book and climbed out of the Land Rover to watch. Lurin and I went to the front of the truck and stooped to it, placing our hands carefully, bending at the knee, spreading our legs a little.
"All the way, partner?"
"All the way, Low."
I grinned back at him, and we began the lift. I started slow, just taking up the slack in my muscles, bringing on the strain evenly and letting it build up in shoulders, thighs, and belly. It was a dead, unmoving mass, and I started to burn the reserves, feeling the tension turn to pain, and my breathing starting to scald my throat.
"Now," grunted Lurin beside me, and I let it all come, rearing back against it with my vision starting to star and pinwheel. It came away smoothly in our hands, and I heard the gasps and startled explanations from the watchers.
We lifted the front of the truck clear of the ravine, went around to the back and did the same there. Then we started to laugh, a little shakily at first, but building up to a full gale. Lurin put his arm round my shoulder and led me back to face our retinue of retainers, who were looking discomfited and uneasy.
"You are," Lurin told them, still laughing, "a bunch of frail old women and giggling virgins." "Translate that for them, Joseph."
I noticed that Joseph gave them a correct rendition of this pleasantry.
"And as for you, Joseph, you're a fool."
Lurin stepped away from me towards Joseph, one quick dancing step, and hit him with an open hand across the side of the head. The sound of it was shockingly loud, and the force of it spun Joseph fully around in a tight circle before throwing him to the ground. He sat up groggily, with a thin trickle of blood running out of the corner of his mouth, where teeth had cut into the thick underlip.
"You see that I'm still laughing," Lurin pointed out to his startled audience. "I'm not even angry yet. Think a while on what may happen to anyone who makes me really angry." The truck was reloaded with alacrity, and we went on.
Well, said Sally, we can be sure of full cooperation for the rest of the trip. Why didn't the big white Bwana use a jambok, rather than soiling his hands?
Tell her, Ben. Lauren did not look round at either of us while I told Sally quickly about the campaign of deliberate obstruction that we'd run into. I'm sure Lauren didn't enjoy hitting the Mansell, but he ditched the truck deliberately. We've got 3.5 days left to get to these hills of blood, and we can't afford any more tricks.
Sally immediately forgot her concern for Joseph.
Hills of blood, she gloated. My God, it conjures up visions of human sacrifice and...
More likely it's merely the red colour on the cliffs, I suggested.
And this taboo thing, she ignored me. It must be because of the ruins. Oh, God, I can feel it in my blood. Temples stuffed with treasures, relics, written records of a whole civilization, tombs and weapons and...
You will notice my assistant's unbiased, unromantic, and thoroughly scientific approach, I pointed out to Lauren, and he grinned.
It irks me like hell, but for once, I feel the way she does, Lauren admitted.
And for once, that makes you smart, dearie, Sally told him tartly.
It was 2 in the afternoon before we reached the point on the eastern extremity of the pan where we were to cut off on compass for the hills. And almost immediately it became apparent that we would not reach them that day. The going was heavy. Sandfelt clutched at the wheels of the vehicles and reduced our rate of progress to a low-gear slog. 6 times the trucks bogged in the thick sand and had to be dragged out by the four-wheel transmission of the Land Rover. Each time this happened, there was a profuse offering of apologies from the driver and crew concerned. The sand had absorbed all traces of the recent rains, but they showed in the new growth of green that decked the thorn and the acacia trees, and more dramatically, in the display of wild flowers that were spread everywhere in carpets and thick banks. Their seeds and bulbs had lain dormant for 3 long years of drought, waiting for this time of plenty. And now the bright crimson of King Shaka's fire burnt brilliantly among the fields of Namaqua daisies, star lilies, ericas, golden gazanias, and 20 other varieties, and they made a royal show and helped to lessen the frustrations of our snail's progress. At every enforced halt, I left the cursing and hustling to Lauren and wandered away from the vehicles with my camera. Sunset found us still 15 miles from the hills, and when I climbed into the top branches of the flat-topped acacia under which we camped, I could see their low outlines on the eastern horizon. The cliffs caught the last slanted rays of the sun and glowed orange-red. I sat in the fork of the main trunk and watched them until the sun was gone and the hills melted into the dark sky. A strange mood gripped me as I watched the far hills. A mystic sense of predestiny filled me with a languid melancholy, a deep sense of unease and disquiet. When I climbed down into the camp, Lauren sat alone by the fire, staring into the flames and drinking whiskey.
"Where's Sally?" I asked.
"Gone to bed in a sulk. We got into a discussion about blood sports and beating up blacks."
Lauren glanced at her tent, which glowed with internal lantern light. There was no singing from the servants' fire, as Lauren and I ate grilled Gemsbok liver and bacon, washed down with warm Red Cape wine. We sat in silence for a while after we'd eaten and finished the wine.
"I'm bushed," Lauren said at last and stood up. "I'll just call Larkin. I promise to check in every second night. See you in the morning, Ben."
I watched him cross to the Land Rover and switch on the two-way radio set. I heard Larkin's boozy voice through the buzz and crackle of static. I listened for a few minutes while Lauren made his report, and then I stood up also and moved away from the campfire.
Restless, and still under the spell of my mood of disquiet, I wandered into the dark again. The Gemsbok carcasses had attracted a pack of hyena to the camp, and they giggled and screeched out among the thorn trees. So I kept close to camp, passing Sally's tent and pausing for a while to draw comfort from her nearness, and then walked on towards the servants' fire. My feet made no sound in the soft sand, and one of the old gun-bearers was speaking as I approached. He had the attention of all the others who squatted in a circle about the low fire. His words came to me clearly and stirred my memory. I felt the tingle of them run along my spine, and the ghost fingers stroked my arms and neck, bringing the hair erect. This evil to be cleaned from the earth and from the minds of men forever. The words were exactly those that Timothy McGeeber had spoken. The same words, but in a different language. I stared fascinated at the lined and time-quadded features of the old Matabili. It was as though he sensed my scrutiny, for he looked up and saw me standing in the shadows. He spoke again, warning them. "Be careful. The spider is here," he said. They had named me for my small body and long limbs. His words released them from the spell that held them. They shuffled their feet and coughed, glancing at me. I turned and moved away, but the old Matabili's words stayed with me. They troubled me, increasing my restless mood. Sally's tent was dark now, and Lauren's also. I went to my own bed and lay awake far into the night, listening to the hyenas and pondering what tomorrow would bring. One thing was certain. By noon, we should know if the patterns on the photograph were natural or man-made. And with that thought, I at last fell asleep. We could see the hills from the front seat of the Land Rover by 10 the following morning. They showed orange-red beyond the tops of the taller acacias, stretching across our front, higher at the center of our horizon, then dwindling in size as they strung out on either hand. I took over the driving from Lauren, while he pored over map and photograph, directing me in towards the highest point of the cliffs. There was a distinctive clump of giant candelabra euphorbia trees on the skyline of the cliff, and these showed up clearly in the photograph. Lauren was using them to orientate our approach. The cliffs were between 200 and 300 feet high, their exposed fronts furrowed and weather-worn, rising almost sheer to the crests. Later I was to find that they were a form of hardened sandstone, heavily pigmented with mineral oxides. Below the cliffs grew a small grove of big trees, and it was clear that there was underground water trapped there to nourish these giants. Their exposed roots twisted and writhed up the face of the cliff like frenzied pythons, and their dense, dark green foliage was a welcome relief from the drab, greenish-gray of the thorn and acacia. In a strip about half a mile wide, the ground before the cliffs was open and sparsely covered with a low growth of scrub and pale grass. I threaded the Land Rover through the scrub towards the cliffs, in a silence which momentarily grew more strained. Closer we crawled towards the towering red cliffs, until we had to crane our necks to look up at them. Sally broke the silence at last, voicing our disappointment and chagrin. "Well, we should be within the great walls of the main enclosure now, if there was one." We parked at the foot of the cliff and climbed out stiffly to look around us, subdued and reluctant to meet each other's eyes. There was no trace of a city, not a single dressed block of stone, not a raised mound of earth, nor the faintest outline of wall or keep. This was virgin African bush and kopje, untouched and unmarked by man. "You're sure this is the right place?" Sally asked miserably. And we didn't answer her. The trucks came up and parked. The servants climbed down in small groups, peering up at the cliffs and talking in hushed tones.
"All right," said Lauren. "While they set up the camp, we'll scout the area. I'll go along the cliff that way. You two go the other way. And Ben, take my shotgun with you."
We picked our way along the base of the cliff through the grove of silent trees. Once we startled a small troop of vervet monkeys in the high branches, and they fled through the treetops in shrieking consternation. Their antics couldn't raise a smile from either Sally or me. We paused to examine the cliff at intervals, but there was little enthusiasm or hope in our efforts. 3 or 4 miles from camp, we stopped to rest, sitting on a block of sandstone that had fallen out from the cliff face.
"I could cry," said Sal. "I really could."
"I know. I feel the same way."
"But the photograph, damn it, there was definitely something showing."
"You don't think it's his idea of a joke, do you?"
"No." I shook my head. "No, Lowe wouldn't do that. He was just as keen as we were."
"Then what about the photograph?"
"I don't know. It was clearly some sort of optical illusion. The shadow from the cliff and cloud, perhaps."
"Yes, but those patterns," she protested, "they are geometrical and symmetrical."
"You know, light can play funny tricks, Sal," I said. "Remember that photograph was taken at 6 o'clock in the evening, almost sunset. Low sun, throwing shadows. You could get almost any effect."
"I think this is the most disappointing thing that has ever happened to me."
And she really did look as though she might burst into tears. And I went to her shyly and put one long arm around her.
"I'm sorry," I said.
And she pulled a face and offered her lips to be kissed.
"Wow," she said at last. "Dr. Kazin, you do carry on."
"You ain't seen nothing yet."
"I've seen too much."
She broke away gently. "Come on, Ben. Let's circle back to camp, away from the cliff. There may be something out there."
We tramped slowly through the heat. The flowers were out here also, and I noticed the bees crawling busily into the blossoms, their back legs thick with yellow pollen. We found where the recent rains had scarred a shallow ravine, although there was no remaining trace of moisture. I climbed down into the ravine and examined the exposed layers of stone and earth. 3 feet from the surface, the pebbles were rounded and water-worn.
"Good guess, Sal," I told her as I picked out a few pebbles and found the shell of a bivalve encrusted in the half-formed sandstone.
"Well, that proves at least a little of our theory. At one time, this was the bed of a lake. Here, look."
Eagerly, Sal clambered down beside me.
"What is it?"
"It's a type of Union ID, a freshwater African mussel."
"I wish," said Sally, "I wish it was something a little more exciting."
"Yes," I agreed, and climbed out of the ravine.
My only excuse is that my reasoning was clouded by intense disappointment, and my recent physical excitement with Sally. I do not usually behave in such a cavalier fashion with scientific clues. Nor do I usually miss as many as 4 hints in the space of an hour. We walked away without a backward glance. The camp was fully set up and functioning smoothly when Sal and I trailed in, sweaty and dusty, and sat down to a lunch of tinned ham and Windhoek beer.
"Anything?" asked Lauren. And we shook our heads in unison and lifted our beer glasses.
"Ooh, warm," Sally spoke with disgust at the first taste of the beer.
"Cook has got the refrigerator going. It'll be cold by tonight."
We sat in silence until Lorin spoke.
"I raised Larkin on the radio while you were away. He'll send in a helicopter tomorrow. We'll have a last search from the air. That'll settle it once and for all. If there's nothing doing, I'll fly out. Some things are brewing back in Johannesburg. And there's only one passenger seat, I'm afraid. You two will have to bus out the hard way.